Berylum Sports.
Hello and welcome to the Verulam Sport Podcast. Every week, the team behind the award-winning Radio Verulam Sport Show will provide you with the most relevant news from the local and regional sporting scenes, whilst keeping you in the picture with national and international bulletins from the world of sport. There will be topical debates, regular interviews from local talent, and chats with those big-name guests that are a mainstay of Verulam Sport. As always, this is your show, every bit as much as it is ours. So, check out Verulam Sport across social media and get involved. For now, prepare yourself for this week's action-packed Verulam Sport Podcast. Hello and welcome again to Verulam Sports Podcast. And I've got to tell you, it is the personal highlight of my own week, getting to chat and debate and dissect all kinds of wonderful sporting topics with the ever erudite Graham Griffin and the man we all love to call the machine, Jason McKenna. And again, as always, this topic tonight is amazing in its diversity. We're going to be discussing what I consider a pantheon, no less, of Hertfordshire-based or associated sporting heroes. And what a diverse list. I'm not going to name names because that's a coming up for you, but it includes a female England cricket star, one of the few Brits to make it in the NFL, also a Knight of the Realm golfer and a world-class Formula One performer, a Premier League footballer, also England international, and something of a boxing star. So a lovely, diverse array. And I love that because that's what it's all about. And this whole topic, can't wait to get into it and get stuck in, has come about once again from you, the loyal listener. Again, democracy rules, and we want to hear from you. Who makes your pantheon of Hertfordshire sporting heroes? Who doesn't make our cut, should have been in? Get involved. It's your show, every single bit, as much as it is ours. And on that note, across the power of social media, people have been getting involved in their swathes. It's an honour to hear from you. Keep involved. Keep tweeting at Verulam Sport. But to give you an overview of some of that exciting opinions from you out there, Jason McKenna, what's been happening? What's the top lines?
Yes, so people have been getting involved with this pantheon of sport from Hertfordshire. You're right there, Tony. And lots of suggestions here, many that haven't made our list indeed. I don't want to spoil who we've chosen, but I'll start off with Twitter here. And Biggest Mickus, he actually came in with quite a funny thing. He said they should close the M25 so that we can have more sport in Hertfordshire with a Grand Prix round there. But he also suggested some local heroes, James Dickinson, John Sayers from St Albans RFC, Rob Saunders from OVs, and Darren Ed from OAs. Then Ian messaged in and said Arsenal and Watford have to be in with a shout because they train in our area. Amy said Ian Poulter, Laura Trott, and AJ Anthony Joshua, and Richard mentioned Gareth Southgate, Vinnie Jones, Jack Wilshere are all great footballers from our area. But I think the nicest story of this week's Hertfordshire heroes comes from Fiona Michelle, who said that she taught Matt Whitlock. She said that she had the privilege of teaching him in Hemel and that he was an absolute delight. What a lovely story there, that we've got a home story of one of these Hertfordshire heroes, Tony.
Absolutely amazing. I tell you what, not only Hertfordshire, but heartwarming stuff there. Brilliant. And keep involved again. You're going to hear us dissect our own pantheon coming up any second now. But again, there's so many who don't make this particular cut. So tweet at Verulam Sport. Get involved. Really encourage you. Want to hear from you. But now we've built it up sufficiently. Without further ado, I'm going to throw it across now to my colleague, the ever erudite, the voice of the Saints, no less. It is the wonderful Graham Griffin. Graham, good evening.
Good evening, Tony and Jason. How are you guys?
Very well.
We're doing
very
good.
Well.
Thanks very much.
I've been eager, thanks, like the beaver, looking forward to this all week.
So, absolutely.
Graham, I tell you what I appreciate about you, sir. There's many, many things. But you are not afraid to go a little bit left field. So kind of on that line, hit me up with your very first entry into the Hertfordshire Heroes debate and list of greats.
Absolutely, Tony. And I have gone off-piste. So you are absolutely spot on. And I've got two to share today, and I'm going to start with the first one. But before I do explain what I've done, I really looked at this Hertfordshire hero, which I think is a great posing question. And I looked at it and thought to myself, okay, well, I'm not going to go with maybe a household name. That was the first thing. And then the second thing, I tried to be very niche and keep it St. Albans. So I was looking for those sort of unknown, if you like, to the wider world, St. Albans, born legends in my eyes, or Hertfordshire heroes, as you say.
Well, Graham, they won't be unknown after this. This is a great platform for you to shine a light, give them the credit that they richly deserve, because they are two superstars. Who is that first?
Absolutely. And the first one is a female cricketer, as you say. And without going into age or anything, which I can see on my phone right now, this person is Ross Birch, born in St. Albans, is an English cricketer and a member of the current England team. And this person is a right-handed batter, right-arm break from a bowling perspective, and also known as an all-rounder. Now, this person has had 139 cap tests, the first being 2003 against South Africa. So she must have been in her teens at that point, or late teens, early 20s. So that's a really young age to play. And the last test, I believe, was 2008 against Australia. But what's really interesting here, playing for Sussex as a team, is Ross obviously was a Hertfordshire hero born in St. Albans. Not sure if she's still affiliated with the city through family or if she resides back here. But definitely really one that I thought, well, actually, she was involved in the Cricket World Cups as well. As on top of that, getting a BA at the University of Sussex in linguistics. So quite a balance there of obviously whilst the female cricket game is developing of the old days of male sport, really, where it used to, in particular rugby, the mixture between being part-time and obviously having a full-time role. So that's my first to kick off with. What's your thoughts with that then, chaps?
Graham, I totally really like that. I've got to tell you, you've given yourself a tough task with your very niche focus, but it is superb to hear you explain a little bit more about the young Birch. And again, what's brilliant, Graham, is that the world of sport from a female perspective has come on leaps and indeed bounds. And to have somebody from literally St. Albans City kind of being at the forefront of that drive is phenomenal. Again, always I respect an all-rounder. They kind of are the heartbeat of any good cricketing team. And to kind of have the ability to bat and also bowl, phenomenal for me. And what a really interesting shout, as you say, to be involved in that World Cup scenario as well. Great, great way to get things rocking and rolling. Quickly, Jason, your thoughts on the left field, although well-structured and brilliantly analysed choice that our friend Graham has just made.
I mean, should we call it right of field because she's a right-handed batsman, you know? No, I do love it, Graham, and you're kind of such a proponent of supporting the area. You know, you're the voice of the Saints, but you've gone with another saint here with Rosalie Birch. She's absolutely amazing, and I love that you're highlighting the fact that she's not just a cricketer, but as you said, linguistics as well. I mean, something not to be sniffed at. An all-round person, it seems, in general, and a great, great shout there for probably somebody that hasn't had enough highlights here, but we're highlighting a true Hertfordshire hero right here.
And I wonder if her family are listening now, must be falling over thinking, whoa, where's this come from? But to give you another quick insight, you know, she's played 7 test matches, 37 ODI games, so obviously one day internationals, and 4 2020 internationals. It's incredible, isn't it? And if that was the opposite sex, we'd probably hear a lot more. And this is what I love the most. Nickname is Cheesy.
Hey, I love that a lot. And I tell you what, Family Birch, if you are listening, we would love to hear from you. We'd love to feature you and give you yet another platform. But that was a wonderful platform provided by GG there. Now, great to give young Birch, a bit of a uplift perhaps. But the two names on the machines list are very much eminently household names. And I'm fascinated to discover who you're going to introduce to this pantheon first. Bring it up, Jason. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I feel kind of almost like I'm lacking here now because of obviously Graham has gone with a really out there, brilliant choice, highlighting, you know, somebody that's not talked about a lot. Whereas I think the first person that I'm going for is well and truly, as you said, a household name. And I've actually gone with Jack Wilshere. And he's somebody, as an Arsenal fan, who brings a real mix of emotions. In terms of Jack, you think of incredible raw talent, a really brilliant young player who broke into the team, and he played an absolute blinder against Barcelona, aged 18. But then on the other hand, it's a whole career kind of littered with injuries. I'd cite that probably 2013-14, he was at his peak of his powers. His through balls, his data. I'm going to bore you with a bit of my stat attack data.
Never underestimate the fact that I appreciate massively your prowess and your knowledge when it comes to data. There is nothing wrong with data. I just don't think we should be a slave to it.
Well, I'll give you a little bit here. So his through balls and dribbles in this 2013-14 season were in the 99th percentile of elite footballers. So that's comparable to the likes of Lionel Messi. He also averaged 0.35 scoring contributions per 90, which is fantastic for a player of his age back then. You know, that's 6 years, 7 years ago now. But then I think the real injury problems came for Jack in 2011-12 when he played 49 games for Arsenal in one season. And for a very young developing player, that's quite risky. And then through the rest of his career, he missed 1,435 days of football, or 216 games, bearing in mind that he's only actually had 254 in total under his belt. So I will say that it's a really mixed career here. It's a real sad story for me as an Arsenal fan, because I genuinely thought he's going to be club captain, one of those players for years, and it's kind of just died away. And I do give a little bit of blame to Arsenal's backroom staff, but maybe just naturally, he's just not a person cut out for maybe the English game. He might have done better in somewhere like Spain. I don't know what you think, Graham and Tony, on that one.
Well, just to pick up on that, first and foremost, Jason, I think it's a really good shout. I mean, let's not forget his early days, and he's in England international, et cetera, et cetera. And he's one of those kind of players that if you kind of could take out the context of time and just kind of look for like YouTube compilations, for instance, he would be comparable with the Messi, with anybody who's ever done it. He had that kind of caliber and that kind of touch, that graceful touch. And as you said, Jason, that game, it springs to my mind as well against Barcelona, because he was a boy, really, a kid, but he commanded the stage like a true giant. And again, you just looked at that and you wished the extrapolation curve would have continued. I think in terms of the injury element, it's an interesting question about the continent and the English style. I think maybe just to kind of take it that point, but slightly different angle, and say, I think there's a bit of a culture in England where there is too much too young. And there is a fascinating kind of loan system, which we're beginning to learn a little bit more about. But for instance, from Serie A, whereby they had so many talented sort of number 10s, and they would not be able to feature. But they would be loaned out to a lower tiered team in the Serie A and get that ability to get game time, but it could be nurtured, it could be managed. Whereas it seems to me in England, as soon as somebody demonstrates that flash of genius or too young, then we expect them to be that bearer of the club, be the one that unlocks all doors and takes that club, in this case Arsenal, to that Champions League kind of level. It's challenging, it's tough, but I think, Jason, I think what a talent. I'm sure when we look back and consider the quality that he brought to the table, we will all have a big smile on our face. A very, very talented man who indeed is a Hertfordshire hero. Graham, your thoughts?
Yes. And so I'm still waiting to see him be a potential player that he should be meeting, Jace. But I don't think it's going to happen, is it? You know, I think that boat has gone. But brilliant shout. I think fantastic. I think it mirrors a little bit what Tony's saying there. I totally agree. And I think what's really interesting with youngsters in professional football in England now is that we're not conscious of this, but we take away their hunger and their desire. And actually, there was a Scottish footballer, what was his name now? Boyd. Adam Boyd, I think he's just finished playing. He made a brilliant comment months ago I saw on Sky Sports News. He said, football's becoming a middle-class game, right? And that was really interesting. And what he was referring to is that actually football's originally a working-class game where working-class lads didn't have anything, struggled, and they had this hunger and desire to just over-excel. And hence why we saw, obviously, football back in the day the way it was, rightly or wrongly. That I thought that was a really interesting comment. So we've got to the point now where these young footballers have got it all mapped out for them quite easy. And we do know, you know, there's been a footballer that didn't have any first team appearances, was getting paid thousands and thousands of pounds per week a couple of years ago and had three transfers without even having a first team experience. So, you know, if you look at Jack Wilshere now, the question is, so what? Right? So what? Why? Jack's not bothered, is he? His hunger's gone. His family's sorted out, right? He's loving it up in Hitchin. That's where he's originally from, is he?
Stevenage,
right. So can you blame the guy? You know, it's interesting, isn't it? So motivation, you could argue, within the individual now, that what gets up at us every morning is to get up and go and do well and survive and provide for ourselves and our family, you know? And you could argue that that's been disappeared in football. So it's an interesting point you make, Jess, about the backroom staff. But yeah, that would be my take on it, Tony.
Appreciate your input. And I tell you what, it could well be a topic for another debate, this whole Pandora's box of unfulfilled talents and the culture of football itself. Again, encouraging you to get involved with your thoughts on that matter. And indeed, everything Hertfordshire Heroes related. Get involved. Tweet at Verulam Sport. But now I feel compelled almost to put on my best...
Your turn, Tony.
My best Michael Buffer impression. Born in 1989, hailing from Watford, Hertfordshire, son of Yetta and Robert Joshua, it is the two-time unified heavyweight champion of the world, the only one of two Brits to hold Olympic gold and a world title at the professional game. I'm talking, of course, about Anthony E.J. Joshua, Watford's own. Look, what a great career. It's only going to get better, you feel. There was obviously that blemish recently against Ruiz Jr. that he subsequently went all the way over to the purpose-built Saudi Arabian stadium and boxed his way back to that unified title. Great, great work. And I'll tell you what I really love about AJ is the fact that he appreciates so much. He's a great gold talent, but a great gold man as well. He came late to boxing, aged 18, when he first actually stepped into the ring, and he flourished. His path, and he's very open about this, was full of kind of misdemeanors and petty crime, and boxing instilled within him a new focus, a new discipline, and a completely different way of perceiving the world. And he's very open about that, and I think gives back accordingly. And kind of reflecting that, and a man who now is a multi-millionaire, coming back to your point about the trappings of sporting success, a multi-millionaire. But I don't know if you can remember this. His earlier coach at the Barnett's amateur ring, a guy called Hughes, kind of they parted company when he moved into the professional ranks. But after the Klitschko fight, which I'm going to reference because it is maybe at the moment the singular most glorious expression of the AJ talent. But after that fight, a brand spanking new BMW 6 Series was delivered from AJ to Sean Murphy by way of a thank you for what you did for me as a youth, getting my head in the game and teaching me the ropes. A gesture again, I guess in context, not a massive amount of money, but my goodness me, not something that was asked for, demanded, or indeed expected, but just a reflection of a man who truly appreciates where he comes from and where he's going next. And that attitude is also, again, very proud Watford man. He represents with aplomb, but he also respects massively his Nigerian heritage too. Both parents come from Nigeria. And I think that kind of respect for that aspect of his culture and his upbringing and his own sense of self is vital to the AJ story. Of course, we all remember the Olympics, Great Britain, London 2012. So many wonderful memories emanate just when you mention the very phrase, London 2012. But one of the highlights must be AJ picking up that title, that gold around the local lad's neck. As I say, he and another St. Albanite, James De Gale, are the only two boxers in history, in British history, who have won a gold medal and gone on in the pro game to pick up world titles. That's a very, very shallow list from a massive, massive amount of history and individuals within that pool. So again, speaking volumes. But he didn't have an easy run to gold. He was actually in the first round against fourth-ranked Colombian, Esande Savon. And this was a little bit controversial, actually, because it was a split decision. It was AJ won, obviously, on points 17-16. But many observers did feel that it might have been a slight aspect of homeboy favouritism there. Nobody will ever know that for a fact. The beauty of boxing, of course, is that sometimes there is that element of flexibility in interpretation. But irrelevant. The marking and the making of a great man is that when opportunity knocks, you knock out. And he did. He continued and on until the final. It was against defending champion. So no easy ride in that regard. Again, it was very tight, a real tussle. The scores were tied at 18 all, but AJ won on a count back and thus grabbed the gold. Come off the hour, come off the man. And then it's just continued on in the pro games. He's obviously gained British Commonwealth titles. In 2016, he became the IBF champ, beating Charles Martin with a second round KO. And then I'm coming to it now because this, for me, is the moment, even today. The Hollywood story, which was his victory over an absolute legend of the game, a man who would make many people's pantheon of boxing all-time fame, Vladimir Klitschko. And granted, Klitschko was aging, age 41, when they battled back in 2016. But this was a war. It was the first time AJ went down in a fight, getting off the canvas, showing that character and that will to not be denied. It was splendid. It was sporting theatre of the highest regard. Honestly, if you watch this match back and you pitched it to Hollywood, they'd say, look, Sly, you're not getting away with this. We've done it. It's just impossible. It is that good. And what a moment. Again, not just his skill, but his will on display. Two true emblems of true gold for me. Since then, maybes there is some people who would say that that may be the apex. Because, of course, there was the AJ, Ruiz blemish I referenced. But in the latter fights, there's been question marks, certainly not about his KO and his power, which is always there with a man of his magnitude, but maybe with his proficiency in head movement, sometimes all too easy to get hit. That was, I think, exposed in a victory in points decision over the New Zealander, Josh Parker. So question marks there. Ruiz, again, exposed that. Of course, let's not forget, Ruiz was an 11th hour step in and one of the biggest rank outsiders since Buster Douglas shocked the boxing world when he beat Tyson way back when. But once again, AJ shows that character to you know, not back away from the sport. He's made his millions, multi-millions. He could have said, well, you know, the AJ story's done. I'll just promote. He could have done all manner of things, not a bit of it. He was humbled and he was ready to rock and roll. And again, took that title back, indeed, three. And what's fascinating for me as a boxing fan and a fan of sport in general is that what we are waiting for soon, when God willing, everything reverts back to quote unquote normal, the world of sports cannot wait for the unification bout, which could well, of course, be an all-Brit affair. Tyson Fury versus the Golden Boy, AJ Joshua, and that will get the whole of the world engaged and debating. And then over 12 rounds, or however many it might be, let's get it on and let's see who indeed is the best. But for now, all I can say is that AJ is an amazing force, a great character, a great man, and a worthy champion who I think is befitting any Hertfordshire Heroes pantheon.
Yeah.
Great choice, Tony. Go on, Jess, sorry.
Yeah, no, I love the shout of Anthony Joshua. And kind of continuing from my point about, and what Graham raised and you raised as well, Tony, about that desire that maybe a lot of footballers, maybe some sportsmen, once they kind of hit a certain level, they lose. But I love watching the documentaries, and also I think the very candid interviews of Joshua as well. He's quite an honest competitor in sport, and I really value that as maybe kind of breaking down barriers on mental health. But beside that, Joshua is so grounded. You know, he still goes back to the kind of same flat. He trains at the same boxing place, and it's almost like a ritual so that he can continue to be, stay humble. Like, it's kind of a phrase that he always says, but he does live by that mantra, and I really value that from somebody who is at the top, as you said, Tony. He is arguably one of the greats in the world today, and maybe one of the greats ever, because of that phenomenal knockout rate that he has. It's crazy how many times.
91% knockout ratio, 23 fights, 22 wins, one defeat, and 21 of those 23 fights being won by way of KO. He's a champ, ain't no question. Yeah. And anyway, now back to another champ, our man Graham Griffin, who's second in your Hertfordshire Heroes selection.
Second, so here we go. Again, I've gone off-piste, and this is a really interesting sort of Hertfordshire hero. This is Josh Muro. Now, Josh is 29 years of age. He's born in St. Albans, so that's my second St. Albion, if that is the term. Get this, he's 6'6", so thinking of Joshua being quite a big man mountain, this is the same for this guy. And what does he do? He's played in the NFL. So he's played in the American football world. He's played for four teams, Pittsburgh Steelers, 2014, Arizona Cardinals, 2014-17, New York Giants, now that's a team, isn't it, 2018, and more recently being at Oakland Raiders. That's really interesting. They signed him, then he moved on, and then they signed him again. It was a very, really odd situation. But they're moving into a brand new stadium in Los Angeles in 2020, this year actually, or potentially going to be next year. Now.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, exactly. So I just thought, what a phenomenal thing. Now, obviously, it looks like his education has mainly been in Texas, and then college was in Stanford, and, you know, still quite a young guy, but must be very physical. And I just thought to myself, that is a great pick for looking at a Hertfordshire hero. Bear in mind that the NFL is huge in America, although, as they would say, it's the biggest sport in the world within America. So the world is in America. But there's not many English guys that are actually playing in the game, albeit of late there's been a bit of a pickup. So I think this is a bit of a gem. And looking at his position and play, he's a defensive end. So he's quite a big guy. He can obviously watch play, tackle. He's had total tackles in the 2019 season, week 16. He had 121 tackles. That's pretty impressive. Not much pass deflection, so that's a good thing. But I just think this is a bit of a gem. Pittsburgh Steelers were huge in the 70s, as we know. New York Giants were very big in the 90s plus. So he's played for some real strong teams there, and it'd be interesting to find out a little bit more about him if he's still connected to St Albans or not. But yeah, what a gem of a find, I thought to myself there, Tony, Jess.
I tell you what, I absolutely love that on a whole array of levels. I'm a massive, massive fan of American football. Huge fan. And yeah, you're right, with the international series, and obviously, as you say, slightly tongue-in-cheekedly, they do call it the, you know, Super Bowl champions of the world, when in fact, realistically, they are pretty much the only nation that partakes. But it is growing, and they are seeking talents, because obviously, you know, we are in a globalized world. Sport, of course, reflects that. But irrespective of the facts of this, I don't know the precise number, but very few Brits have actually made it in the NFL, because quite frankly, very few people who actually play the game of American football make it in the NFL. This is a sport which is all about elite of the elite. And to make that cut, to play at that level, is a reflection of a man of supreme talent, mega physical attributes. I mean, these guys are athletes of almost terrifying force. The speed with which these defensive ends move, their bulk and their mass is beyond terrifying. We are talking almost Buffalo-esque kind of force here. So to achieve that, to have found a way, again, almost as an outsider into the NFL, making those 100-plus tackles, is a real massively positive indictment of that young man. Again, not a household name, but I tell you what, we should remember his, because he is an absolute legend. And another, use the word gem, I would use the word genius.
Genius, so, I like it, Tony. Just to quickly come in on that as well, and you know, there's two other things to add, is it's a real brilliant positive highlight of how American college sport is superb. They take it very seriously. They study, and we are catching up, in particular in football, with the money that's involved in that. But it'd be great to see more sports doing the same over here, because it, you know, it's healthy, and as you say, it's really difficult to get to that level. So for a Brit to do it is brilliant. And the second thing is, there's been the international series mainly at Wembley. Now it's going to be Wembley and Spurs since 2007. So they've been here 13 years, and there's been anything from one game, it's going to increase to four. So give it 20 years' time. You know, we're going to be talking a lot about NFL, and in particular, we've got the Hertfordshire Cheetahs, haven't we?
Friends of the show. They'll be back for sure. Greg, just real quick on the international series before we kind of move things on. I'll invite Jason's quick take on your take there. Basically, what's actually struck me over the international series is precisely that. Obviously, you've got the predominance of American fans coming over for the trip. But, you know, you talk to people there from all over the continent of Europe, all over England, and it's just a real carnival. It's phenomenal. I'm going to really miss it this year round. I truly am. But again, we mustn't forget sports in context. But I'll tell you what. What's impressive, though, for me, is just how knowledgeable the Brits are actually becoming about the NFL compared to when I first got into it, like 20 plus years ago now, when most people didn't know a quarterback from a cornerback and, you know, what have you. Okay. These days, there is that wealth of knowledge. And I tell you something, you made an interesting shout, and I'm going to upgrade it. There will be a London-based franchise playing in the NFL within that generation. I suspect it will be sooner rather than later. I haven't got a shadow of a doubt in my head. Anyway, Jason, your quick thoughts on Mr. Monroe.
Yeah, I love the shout once again, Graham. Lovely stuff. As always, you know, you kind of put it out there with your exploration. I actually had two questions for you, though, Tony, in terms of NFL. As you said there, you know, you've been a big fan for 20 odd years. So my first question is kind of, what started your passion? What was the main draw? And my second point is kind of talking maybe crossover of sports here. One of the big British sports is obviously rugby. Why don't we see more rugby players kind of making that transition to the big money of the NFL?
Jason, I'll tell you what, they're two superb questions. What got me into American football really was that since I was a kid, I was just a massive lover of pretty much any sport. If it was going on, there was competition on, I was all involved. But really, what kicked that off for me that love of sport initially wasn't American football, but was indeed rugby union. Growing up in Leicester, where once upon a time the Tigers from Leicester were almost the Man United-esque dynasty style, those days have faded. But nevertheless, you're right to observe that there is a possibility there. But here's the thing. Martin Johnson, who is a Rugby World Cup winner, no less, and one of the all-time greats of the game, and also a really much a aficionado across multitude of sports. He really is a passionate fanatic of all things sporting. Anyway, he used to play, for instance, for the Leicester Panthers at the time in the 80s, just in sort of off-season. This was actually when rugby union was still an amateur game, okay? He played, I think, tight end. Anyway, and he breaks it down like this. I think it's a wonderful deconstruction. It says, rugby union is a contact sport. American football, according to Mr. Johnson, is a collision sport. And that it kind of expresses it. But also, unless you kind of grow up, and this is why the shout for Munro is so good, Graham, because unless you actually grow up from a young age, kind of getting familiar with the nuances of American football. Again, knowledge is growing here. But honestly, I still watch it. I've been a fan for 25 years. And I get the overview and I get the tactics. And I understand, I think, to a pretty solid level. There are so many things, though, that get kind of on a sub-level and then even a more kind of modular level. It is a very, very simple game, but to truly master requires a massive, what they refer to as a football IQ. And unless you're very lucky to kind of grow up in that culture, it's such a different sport in that it is just every single position is uber specialized and has within that an uber mini subset of specialisms. So it's for that reason that there hasn't yet been this culture of crossover. I'm not entirely sure that ever will be, but it will be interesting to witness Wade, ex-England player, who was, I think, at the Bills and made lots of YouTube fame last season because he did return a kickoff, which was very, very impressive. But then you didn't hear from him since. That was, by the way, in the preseason. So we'll watch out for Wade and see how he does his thing. It's great that there have been Brits like our own, St. Albans' own Munro, getting it done in the NFL. But I think we'll be many, many more moons hence before this becomes a regular transition or crossover.
I find it fascinating as well, you know, the NFL kind of crossover there. But I suppose I should bring it on to my other Hertfordshire hero. And this one, again, you know, you've talked about AJ Joshua here. We've got a bona fide another world champion here, this time a six-time world champion, and it's none other than Lewis Hamilton. And a little bit later, I think I'm going to come out with a bit of a controversial point. So everybody, make sure you're sitting down. But in terms of Lewis Hamilton, I've loved him from day one. You know, I love Formula One as a sport, and he debuted in 2007, and he took the sport by storm from then. He was so unlucky not to win his debut season. He missed out by 1 point to Kimi Raikkonen. Then 2008, he probably had one of the greatest, most dramatic wins of all time. That 2008 victory against Felipe Massa at Brazil. He didn't win the race, but it was literally last corner, last second stuff where he claimed victory. Then, you know, there's been low points of his career. 2009-12, problems at McLaren kind of saw that he wasn't competing at that level. He had fourths, he had fifth places, which isn't, you know, the usual kind of thing for Lewis. But then since 2014 and the change to the turbo with hybrid engines that we've seen in Formula One, Mercedes, the team that he moved to, quite surprisingly so in 2013, because they'd just made it back into the sport and hadn't really challenged. Suddenly, since 2014, they have dominated that era. What I would say as well, a lot of people said that, oh, he's lucky to be in a fantastic car. But first of all, I'd say he made the conscious decision to move to Mercedes. It wasn't clear cut. It wasn't, moving to like Ferrari or McLaren at their peak. It was a big big thing. And I would also say that in one of those seasons since 2014, he lost out to Rosberg. He was pushed very close by Vettel. He's been pushed close by many others. But the fact of the matter is that he's turned, you know, deficits into positives. He's a never say die kind of driver. And I just think he's absolutely fantastic. For me, I'm going to say it, he's my favourite of all time. I think he is the best of all time. And I will say more so than Senna, who was before my previous favourite. But I think he is as good as Senna, but a little bit more. I think Senna was a little bit too erratic at times. And I would highlight 1988 Monaco Grand Prix, where Senna was miles ahead. He didn't have to continue racing like a madman. Whereas Hamilton in those kind of situations would nurse it back home. Might be slightly more boring, but at times Hamilton is as good in the wet. He is as dangerous. He will go for those moves. And for me, he is the best ever. It's not a question of, are his achievements valid? My question is, how far ahead will he be of everybody else when his career ends?
It's a really, really, really powerful argument. And I tell you what, you made it brilliantly. I still reserve judgments because I find sometimes comparing eras fascinating, but very, very challenging because, again, the dynamics, particularly with this element of the mechanic aspect, which has gone through so many different transitions and phases, it becomes nuanced. But I love the fact you've broken it down and you've had the passion to assert that so powerfully. And it's not one that I'm really particularly inclined to quibble with you and Dooley. I will still come back to, at the moment, Michael Schumacher, who again had that early powerful burst at Benetton and then, of course, cemented his hegemony as the current number one in the winningest sense with seven. At the Ferrari drive. But as you say, I actually never thought in my lifetime I would witness somebody get close to Schumacher's seven. And the fact that, as you say, Hamilton already has six, has the world at his feet, still young, if he's still got that internal drive, then you really can only but see one name topping that winningest list. And when there is almost impossibilities to compare, you're going to have to come back to, well, who has accumulated the most? And you're right, it's not pie in the sky to pitch that as Hamilton, maybe within literally 2 years, perhaps. We shall see. I've got a quick question, though, just before I invite Graham in, to you, Jason. I posed this to Kerry recently. You may well have heard on our podcasting in terms of the Ferrari brand engine machine. Formula One needs a competitive Ferrari outfit, doesn't it? Because as great as it has been, this dynasty now that Hamilton's built, as he's just etched his way up towards that now sixth title, in that other interim where, you know, it was another one of his co-drivers who got the title, meaning that it is very much dynasty McLaren now. And I find that not good for the overall well-being of F1. So, yeah, we need, I think, Jason, your thoughts on a powerful or at least highly competitive Ferrari.
For me, I'd rather it wasn't Ferrari because I feel like they get a lot of benefits. You know, the FIA gives them the quote loyalty bonus and things like that. For my sake, I do agree that it needs to be more competitive. The fact that it's six construction wins back to back, it is kind of harking back to, as you said a little bit earlier, winningest man himself, Schumacher era, where Ferrari just dominated and it got boring at times. But what I would say is the past couple of seasons, we've seen Red Bull kind of push. We have seen Ferrari, and I think it's been a little bit of a failure from Sebastian Vettel, if I'm honest. And I would argue that this season, Leclerc has shown that he will be possibly in the mould of Lewis Hamilton and maybe going up there as well. But that is all if, buts and maybes in the future. But I think the future of F1 is secure in the sense that there's a lot of really good young drivers. And also some of the teams are becoming more competitive. I like the looks of Red Bull because they always seem to make a really good chassis, a really good car, and they will be pushing. And they too made the jump towards Honda engines, so that was kind of a big shout there. We shall see with Ferrari, because obviously they've got a new lineup this year. We've got Carlos Sainz, we've got Leclerc. So what do you think about that, Tony?
Tell you what I'm going to say about that. I'm going to defer it like this and simply state, if you are fascinated to hear my little tuppence on that, and also the in-depth analysis from the wonderful Kerry Cobb, make sure you check out all the Verum Sport podcasting. You can find it across any way that you can access your podcast. And of course, the easiest way is to go to radioverum.com to check out podcasting and find it there. Don't just check us out there. There are a whole array of wonderful podcasts up there. But in our wonderful podcast now, quickly, Graham, before I complete the pantheon, your take on Lewis Hamilton, because whilst I am enthusiastic, Jason's made a wonderful case. I don't think anybody can really doubt the record. He's kind of Marmite. The Brits don't seem to love him as much as I think they should. What's your take, Graham, and your thoughts on Lewis Hamilton?
Great point, Tony. And I think he, when you think of Hertfordshire, he's probably the first person we all think about, don't we? We know his story. It's quite well publicised, being brought up in Stevenage with his brother and his dad. What I look at, you know, when he won that first championship, that sticks with me. I was like, oh, wow, what a brilliant story. Love it. And then after that, I got a little bit bored when he got to the third, fourth one. But obviously, it'd be nice now if he progresses. But I do enjoy when he's at Silverstone. I like how he does rally the Brits behind him. It's interesting, there's this sort of Marmite thing with him. I don't really get it myself, because I look at the guy and I think three things. I love his desire. I think that's excellent for any sports athlete person. I think he's very single-minded. You need that when it comes to, you know, a human being working with a machine. And I just love how he's a bit of a risk taker. I love it. I love it how he just goes. He goes beyond his own mechanics. His race director against his opponents. You just see how he goes into that tunnel vision and he's like, I want to win. And he's a competitor. So for me, the psychological side of it all, I just think outstanding choice.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think worthy of any pantheon, certainly any F1 pantheon and certainly any Hertfordshire pantheon. But seriously, he is amazing. No questions about it. I don't understand that Marmite thing. But if you are one of those people out there, the beauty of life, the beauty of sport is that everybody has an opinion and yours could be divergent to ours. So tell us, tweet us at Verum Sport and say, hey, well, he may be this and that, but, you know, we just don't like the way he conducts himself. And true athletes maybe had ought to conduct themselves in a certain fashion. Whatever your opinion is at Lewis Hamilton or, you know, at AJ Joshua or indeed anybody that we brought to this pantheon, I'd love your views. Keep them coming. This is your show every bit as much as it is ours. Keep involved. Now, to finish the pantheon, I'm going to choose somebody who is as wonderful as everybody has been on this list and so divergent, which I truly love, gentlemen. This guy is unique in the sense he is the only knight of the realm in this order. I've gone for Sir Nicholas Faldo, born in 1957 in Welling Garden City. He's one of only 19 men all time since the golf rankings began back in 86. So one of only 19 men to actually be ranked number one golfer on planet Earth. So a very elite little club that he has a part of. He was, in fact, a number one there for 97 weeks, which is an impressive stint. And it's a phenomenal career. He came to the game late. And actually, this is one of the things I love about sport. And it's actually going to be mirrored in this narrative I'm going to tell about Faldo. But he himself describes watching Nicholas, the great and indeed the winningest major golfer of all time, play at the Open on his mum and dad's brand new colour TV at the time, right? I mean, guys, can we remember before there was HD? There was colour! Amazing. But the point is that inspired young Nick to such a degree that he, you know, this is what I want to do with my life. It was a penny drop moment. And, you know, he's gone on to such great, great things. He is up there with the all-time best. His six majors, including three Open Championships, 87, 1990 and 92, sit alongside three Masters and the Masters course at Augusta and the ritual of the ceremony of getting that green jacket is up there amongst anything in all walks, shapes, forms of sport. It is that prestigious. He's, I think, 12th all time on the winningest list with those six majors, equal with Lee Trevino. So again, he walks with the elite of the elite when it comes to the world of golf. He has also an impressive Ryder Cup record, which is where golf gets a bit of a team element. Again, USA versus Europe. Up until Garcia beat it in the most recent Ryder Cup, Faldo, with his record of 25 points from 11 Ryder Cup events, was the best. So once again, because there's another thing about Faldo, also has that Marmite property, I would say, because he's perceived as almost to a fault single-minded. But then that argument doesn't seem to hold water with the stats or the facts of his record in the team context of the Ryder Cup, which he always played with great pride and great endeavours. For me, though, when I think of Nick Faldo, spinning it back to the power of sport to inspire, I can remember precisely with where I was in 1996, where we had one of the finest bits of sporting theatre that I've ever witnessed. I was there in my living room with my dad. I wasn't a big fan of golf at the time. And it was on. Faldo went in to the final round of Augusta, and he was trailing the great white shark, Greg Norman, the Aussie, by a huge amount. He was trailing by six shots going into the final round. And just the will, that almost beyond the physical element of the game, it was a mind game. And this was sporting theatre of the finest. And hole by hole, you could see Faldo's shoulders getting bigger. You could perceive, by contrast, Norman beginning to wilt as he was literally hunted down. Seeing Faldo claim his last major, 96 at Augusta, his third of three green jackets, and his sixth major overall. It was, for me, one of the most supreme illustrations of the power of the human mind in remarkably intense, pressurized conditions, with a wonderful aesthetic of the Augusta golf course. He was the master at the Masters that day, and it was sublime. Sir Nicholas Faldo, you are one of the finest sports people our country has ever produced. You hail from Welwyn Garden City, and I can only but honour you into our pantheon of Hertfordshire heroes. So there we go. Thoughts on Faldo, gentlemen?
Yeah, I love that. The passion that you infuse there, Tony. I think in many ways it's kind of you telling a love story, the moment that you fell in love with the sport. I don't think
I love Nick Faldo. I'm happy to say it. I'm comfortable.
Yeah, it's not hyperbole to like say that was the moment that you fell in love with the sport. Then I just love that narrative that you did there. I think, you know, there's no question that he's one of the best, and the fact that he provided not only just one of the best careers in golf, but one of the best sporting moments probably ever to turn that round in 1996. So yeah, kind of like what you said with Lewis Hamilton, I can't really add any more apart from I just love that shout, Tony.
Yeah, and I think, Tony, brilliant shout with, you know, considering we're in St. Albans, the whole Samuel Ryder connection. I love how you've pulled in a golf person, and who better than Mr. Nick Faldo himself. And if I think back to the 90s, outside of the main sports growing up, as you were saying, is there was two key people, weren't there, that probably everybody looked at, which was Nigel Mansell and Nick Faldo. You know, they were just doing something extraordinary in the sports that wasn't the top three in the UK at the time. And we didn't really have the sports coverage we have on TV these days to understand things a little bit easier. So I think back then, for them two individuals to push through and actually get so much exposure and following, I thought was phenomenal. And the final thing for me with Nick Faldo is he always to me seemed like he was a gentleman. I've never met him, but he came across as a gentleman, which suggested to me when I was younger growing up, which all people with privilege, i.e. celebrities, sports personalities, should always be mindful of, is to me, Nick Faldo was a role model, right? He was somebody to look up to and think, I want to look or sound like this guy. I don't want to be able to have a skill or a talent like this guy. It just gave you that enthusiasm. And I just thought, you know, that's the typical iconic sports personality I would probably look at and go for.
He was immense. Indeed, everybody in this list has been. But always, I'm sure you've been listening in and you've got your views. We want to keep them coming. Tweet at Verum Sports and anything sports related. We want to hear from you. Remember, always, it's your show every bit as much as it's ours. So get involved. I want to thank you massively for listening again. Make sure you're back next week. We've got some amazing things coming up. I can't wait to hear the second part of Graham Griffin, Ian Allinson. Absolutely must listen. If you are a fan of sport, if you're a St. Albans fan, that one, just get it on. You can't not have that as part of your life. Awesome chat coming up also with the newest recruit to the wonderful Kickoff at 3 team, friends of the show. And we massively appreciate their endeavours. Check out Spinoff at 3 too. Wonderful interview. Great stuff coming up, plus a whole heap more. We'll be back next week. And I thank you once again for listening. All the best.